All righty. Well, good morning. My name's Julie Fedorchak. It's 9:35, and we are gathered for a work session on the Northern States Power Company natural gas rate increase. Work session seems like a weird title for this, but I don't know what else we call it. So I guess it is a work session. Here are Commissioners Randy Christman and Sherry Haugen-Huffert. And so we have a quorum, but we're not taking any action. We're just talking, so I guess that doesn't really matter. Also have Jack Hsu and Pat Vaughn on staff. And so basically this, Jack and I talked about this. It's a practice that we started a couple rate cases ago that was kind of restarted after a significant gap where we didn't really have these kinds of discussions on the front end of rate cases. But my thought in chatting with Jack about it was we had the public input session. We heard some feedback. It's still early in the process where, you know, the parties are developing their cases. So this is an opportunity for all of us to talk about issues that we're seeing already in the case that we might want to explore more and have some light shined on, attention drawn to. And so really that's the nature of our discussion this morning, is just to share what we're thinking about already in the case. So, Randy, do you have any opening comments?
No, I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Sherry?
No, I do not.
Okay. So, Jack or Pat, do you guys want to provide any framing for the discussion, or should we jump right in to discussion matters?
I guess the only thing I'd like to add to the preface that you provided, Commissioner Fedorchak, is that the real reason for the policy that was set forth, I mean, eons ago, or that we had been doing this, and you're right that we restarted this, was largely due to the fact that the split staff aspect. There's no way that you guys can communicate these thoughts back and forth unless we have this open meeting. So this really is the opportunity for you guys to advise advocacy staff to dig into, as you said. And so just I wanted to discuss that, explain that split staff portion as a purpose for this.
Perfect. Excellent. All right, Patrick, any thoughts?
No, I guess I don't have anything to add on the purpose and the reason for this meeting, but if you have a place to start in discussion of the things you want to see done in the by advocacy staff, investigated by advocacy staff, we can go there. I also had prepared a kind of a summary of the case. I don't know if you still have that, but it lists the major drivers of the rate case.
Yeah, I do have that. I'm not sure if Sherry does, mm-hmm. but maybe you can walk through that, and I'll get a copy.
Is that the September 9th one?
Yes. Yes. I think I provided one to Sherry. And
oh, so who's she making a copy for? Oh.
While we're waiting for Julie to make those copies real quick, did you, maybe it'd be helpful, I don't know if you discussed in your memorandum, Pat, I guess the current status of the rates with a NSP?
The status of the rates?
Yeah, was that included in your memorandum as well?
I'm not sure.
For example, the cost of gas, the undercollected cost of gas from the February event and so forth. And
that is not included.
Okay. I guess for, I know Commissioner Christman and Julie were both here, Commissioner Fedorchak were both here for that portion, but obviously I know you're aware of the February event and that resulted in some large undercollections for Xcel Energy. There were two orders that were done by the commission after that. Once was initially there was a 15-month amortization period for recovery of those undercollected costs that was ordered, and I think that was in maybe July or August of last year. But then I think in October then we extended it out, and that was right around the beginning of this rate case, to a 24-month period to end on June of 2023. The average undercollected balance resulted in residential customers specifically. I'm not going to go into the other customer classes, having an average monthly impact of $9.78. So next year, around 2023, what we would anticipate is when that period ends, that average additional undercollected value that they're collecting for that 20-month amortization period will then fall off. Which then they asked for an interim rate increase as well. I don't remember the initial amount they asked for, but it resulted after some filings by advocacy staff being reduced down to $6.99 million, I think it was the interim rate increase, which they're statutorily allowed to have, which is just a little bit less than the 7.1% application for the recurrent rate increase. So they're currently collecting that under-recovered balance from that February event. And at the same time, since October, around that time when they filed the application, they're also recovering that interim rate increase as well for the current period until this rate case is finished. And if there was a reduction in the amount of the total ask under that interim amount, they'll subsequently get a refund. Or the customers will get a refund of that value.
You should turn your mic on, Sherry. Sure. It's maybe just leave it on.
So that's over $15 per customer, that $9 plus the six?
Well, I'm not sure what the actual interim rate value was per customer. There was a $6.9 million interim rate increase for value. How that goes through the class or to each individual customer, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. But there's a good chance that it's probably around at least, I would have to say $15. $14, $15 is probably about right.
Wasn't it about $5 for the gas?
For the current increase, we're looking at about $5.
No, I mean for the winter event.
I have it listed as $9.78.
I thought it was less, too.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I thought it was.
I do have the order available. But
anyway, but it varies, too. That might have been an average. The $5 was probably an average between the seasons because it's a seasonal rate. So, anyway. Okay, did these numbers change?
Can I just add something to that? Because I don't know if it's clear that the cost of gas thing that Jack explained was originally 15 months and extended to 24. The amount of it is abnormal. And the length of it, usually it would be a year. The mm-hmm. original thing with 15, it was just because it was going to start toward fall and it was so much, we decided to do like this past summer and the following summer to spread it out a little, and then ultimately the decision to make it 24 months. And so that's odd, but that rider kind of happens every year to true up the cost of gas from what was expected. And some years it's a premium that's added for the following year. And actually some years it's a refund that gets subtracted from their monthly bill because it's designed to hit as close as possible as you go. And then at the end of the year, you true it up and spread it over the next year. And in this case, 2%.
Are there any of those things you would like me to go into any more depth on, or should we just move on to the recast?
We can move on.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did these numbers change, though, since September? Right, because they refiled.
Yes.
Okay, we don't need.
These are the numbers from the original filing.
Yeah. Okay. Alrighty. So have we walked through the basics?
I just walked through the current status of the rates from the February event to the interim.
Perfect.
Rates to here, just to give her a little bit of background.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, so we had our public input sessions and. AARP didn't like the, they were one of the main folks that spoke and didn't like having the rates being collected through the monthly service charge and added to that. And so that's been a standard position that they've had in a number of rate cases. And they thought the overall, the ROE was too high. And that They also suggested that we should have gotten public input sooner, which I thought was a little bit unusual because we pretty much always do the public input in about the same time in relation to when we start having the hearings, et cetera. Don't we? I mean...
Yeah, that's the normal manner in which we get public input. And I might be wrong, too. I thought he wanted to actually later. Maybe you wanted one sooner and then the subsequent one later.
I put comment later in the case after. Yeah.
Right. But I guess, and I think the point of the whole public input when it was originally started was, here we're opening up a case. It's out there. This information's out there. There's any information that any member, industry, public, or a commercial group would have that would aid us in our evaluation and, of course, also guide our investigations. That was our opportunity to really get that input. So the purpose of it having at that point is that exact reason.
And actually, one of my things that I want to discuss here came from that. And so I guess I view that the public input sessions and the early timing of them is doing for us exactly what we're doing now for advisory staff to, you know, are there certain things that people want us to look into? And I'm just like, now we're telling you guys some of the things that we want specifically looked into.
Sure.
I agree. I think that, so you like it the way we have it?
I do.
And I agree it's valuable, but I also think it's worth thinking about another public input session after some of the issues have been brought to light. Now, maybe it's difficult if they're an intervener, you know, depending, like interveners wouldn't be coming forward in a public input session. But other members of the public, after they hear some of the, or have the ability to look at some of the filings, might have things to say. Is there a reason why we couldn't?
Pat? I was just thinking advocacy staff likes to know, you know, what they should look into early on, very early on. In fact,
yeah, I'm not saying get rid of that. I'm just saying add another.
That have a different purpose for the second one.
Yeah.
I guess from the normal standard procedure, it wouldn't provide as much value, in my opinion. It's nice to have those to gather the information, but it would be so late in the game. It's not like it would make it into it. We wouldn't be able to have time to turn consultants or advocacy staff to rewrite testimony and so forth to address those things, and for the most part, in most of those cases.
Right.
Because they said they wanted it after advocacy staff has already filed their, their testimony and so forth. And that window gets really tight. And to also change the issues and then allow people to then subsequently file more testimony and then rebuttal testimony, it could end up pushing out the case a period of time.
Well, when can the public, like, what if they came to the hearings and offered testimony? What would we do with it then?
We would probably receive it.
Right.
Yeah.
But we'd have to, but we'd even be less able to deal with it.
Sure. But,
you know, at that point. So this would get some of that earlier on where we wouldn't be actually in the hearings or after a settlement's been filed or whatever.
Well, we still receive public comment this whole period through as well. If this is what we'd like to do, we can do it. But it's not like there's zero venue where they can interact. We have our monthly reports. We know what they're saying about the case. And to the extent that there's a substantive issue, you guys are always made aware of it as well. I know you guys read through all the public comment
right.
with reports.
Seems a little different just having just general public comment or making a concerted effort to receive it through like a public input process, a second one. You know, I mean, we'd have news release going out saying we've got these public input sessions and here's when it is and let us know what you think. And that's different than just our standard, like, sure, we take it if you send it, but we aren't asking for it.
No, I don't object to doing another one, but I will say this. To some extent, it's just an opportunity to be argumentative. You know, we'll hear from the people who think we're not raising the rates enough and the ones who think we're raising them too much. But if anyone brings up anything new, I guess there could be time we could really slow down the case and go back and have it dug into more if someone has something new. But just someone saying, well, you know, this is just too high, it's unaffordable. Well, you know, that doesn't establish evidence that we can use to reach our ultimate conclusion anymore at that point either. We needed to have heard that, as we did here from some people, so that everyone could have dug into it and try and work on the best solution to the case that we can. I'm just not sure it does a lot of good.
Well, and it might not, but I also don't see us being overwhelmed with public engagement on these rate cases, and I don't see the downside.
Sure.
But if there is a downside, I'd love to hear, I'd love to think about that.
I'm not saying there's a downside, but I'm just asking for clarification, is that they have the opportunity to bring forth opinion. It's an open case, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have that opportunity. It's open for them to bring the information,
right.
And we have the due diligence to review it. So we're still meeting the public need, which I support,
mm-hmm.
Commissioner, but I just don't want to slow things down either, get bogged down. In that, so
yeah.
As long as they always have that avenue and it's there, then I don't think we're...
I would say it's premature to say we get bogged down because we've never tried it.
That's okay. Fair.
So...
The one thing, so we do, you're right that we, who knows? And who knows how much we'll have?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think in the last public input we had ARP and they were the main comment
right.
writers, and now they would not be able to.
Yeah, if they're,
so
yeah, because they're intervening.
So it may not be too cumbersome at that point in time. We do have time limits, which we're supposed to statutorily finish
mm-hmm.
up these cases. And all this information that we receive now is generally outside the evidentiary proceedings. So if we do receive something substantive, and if people think that they can wait till that latter period of time to provide that, it may, if we have to do a substantive change in a testimony or something like that, it could, that's where the slowing down of the process would
right.
probably come. So,
look at the schedule that's outlined and see where there might be a window for it and just look at it.
Sure.
I'm not saying we even do it at this point, but just look at the schedule that's been framed up and see if there might be a time to slip in another, public input session.
You would probably have to do in about, I imagine, within about a month from now.
Okay, I don't have the schedule in front
sure.
of me of the filings and stuff, so I don't know where that would, where it would fit in. But the hearing isn't until June, though, right?
It is until June. I think there's we have testimony on Tuesday, then there's rebuttal testimony after that. So then there is a gap between.
Okay, so that would be
so
the,
between
the
rebuttal
option.
And
yeah,
probably is would be the sweet spot.
You know, and maybe nobody tries, but or maybe nobody comes forward with any public input.
Right,
It might be worth trying. I will say, I was trying to think, okay, what would be the downside?
Mm-hmm.
If there is one that I can think of, and maybe this is kind of nothing, people become kind of accustomed to testimony on legislative issues, where for a lot of people, some of the decision is based on, do most of the people want this law or don't they want it? And so you open this up and you have 2-3 hours of public testimony. We know what I say it lightly sometimes about the ones who wanted a bigger raise and a smaller raise, but
yeah.
We all know they're all going to call in and say it should be less.
Mm-hmm.
It's already too high. And so then are people misled into thinking that that solves the problem? They've let us know now that they don't like it. They heard the whole thing. Everybody was against whatever size increase is being discussed, and so they feel like now they solved the problem without understanding our obligation to provide recovery of just and reasonable costs and a fair rate of return.
Well,
as
to the extent
to just a popularity contest.
Yeah, to the extent that people show up and listen, we have the opportunity to do some of the education on how it all works, which is pretty valuable because we spent a lot of time at the first one talking about how the interim rate increase wasn't what they're seeing. It's already being collected. And so we aren't talking about a doubling of their rates based on what they're currently paying, which is a lot of money, and most of it is on gas, cost of gas. So that was pretty helpful explaining to people, having that opportunity to explain that, what exactly the rate is that might be increasing and how much it might be.
Sure.
So if it's okay with you guys, let's just look and see what it might look like to try to fit one in, and when and how long and all that sort of stuff. I doubt that we'd be overwhelmed with input because we didn't have a lot this first time around, but I thought it was a reasonable suggestion anyway from AARP. Okay. I have a list of ideas that I would like to talk about, but I don't want to, you know, take over with my stuff first if others want to throw things out, or if Pat, if you have a list of things, or do you want me to just get started?
I have a list too, but it looks like it's shorter than yours, so.
Do you want to go first then?
Why don't we take turns?
Sure.
You go first because you have more.
All right, let's see. So the time of day, let's see. Okay, some of these are, so let's, for starters, there was some discussion that was brought up about the cost difference for industrial / commercial versus residential. And cost / rate difference for the industrial, commercial, and the residential. So I haven't looked at what that currently is, but I want to, you know, understand. And we usually do look at that pretty carefully on the rate design. So that is one thing that I, in terms of the rate design, so there's two things on the rate design, that, and then I am... after the last gas case, where we really did focus mostly on the fixed variable, what was it called?
Straight fixed variable.
Right? Straight fixed variable, such a sensible term. Straight fixed variable. I am not sold on that anymore. So I want to be able to look at other options.
So I guess just the other options that we'd be you would like advocacy staff then to bring a couple different types of rate designs. One, because we would always bring the straight fixed variable rate because that's precedential,
right?
And it's kind of established by the commission, but another option as well with a departure from that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And some of the rationale for. I mean, I understand the rationale for the straight fixed variable, but there are downsides to that too, and there's a saturation point for, you know, like Xcel maybe we aren't at that saturation point yet, but I do want, I'm uncomfortable just that's how we're doing it, and that's how we're going to do it from now until infinity, because that's the precedent at the commission, and like, so all gas companies can expect to get all of their rate increases covered in that format. That's not sustainable, I don't think. So moving forward, especially in light of the system needs that we know are out there for refreshing, et cetera, I mean, we can't afford to put all of those costs on the straight fixed variable design, I don't think. So.
Okay.
Randy?
The request is still 10.5% ROE, right?
Yes. 10.5 is the request.
Yeah. I know there's been talk of some upward ticks and interest and what that could lead to around the nation and all sorts of of lending and such, but it doesn't seem to be happening quickly. I think, too, that that does seem high. And I failed to make a note of who said it. I don't know if I just changed pins, and this was still from AARP, or if it was a different speaker that I forgot to note. But someone pointed out that surrounding states are doing 9 to 9.5%. And so I'd sure like to know more about some of the surrounding states, not necessarily just Minnesota, and where we're at, and make sure whatever ROE we end up at, that we have good rationale for it.
Sure. At least through this past year, from my review, the ROEs from gas utilities have been trending down to below 9.5. The electric utilities, of course, have been staying a little bit higher, but that's pretty normal.
Okay.
All right, should I go next?
Mm-hmm. Unless Sherry has some.
Not yet.
Okay, so deferred maintenance. I wrote that on my list. And so just exploration of what has gone on in terms of deferred maintenance and what's the company's practice, and was there a lot of deferred maintenance in the interim between the rate cases that we're now playing catch up for? So just that issue in general.
Julie, can I step back to that previous item that you were discussing, just because I want to make sure I understood you correctly. You were discussing the difference in rate design and, I guess, class cost of service, I'm assuming, between commercial and industrial and residential uses.
Yep.
So
where we're at, make sure that we're, where is the subsidization occurring, okay, if any.
Okay, just some more of a general where we have a subsidization with those rate classes.
Yeah, and if there's anything other that you can think of that we should be exploring there, I'm open to that, but that's what comes to mind.
Sure.
So you're good on, ready for the next one?
Okay. Thank you.
So one of the things that we did hear during the public input session, and this person calling in just sounded very reasonable, not like just looking to holler at someone. But Beth from Fargo talked about her bill numbers, and it's one thing with doing these things virtually. The people aren't here. They don't bring a copy of things. We can't look at specifically what they have, and if there's a misunderstanding, point it out. And so I don't know. And there was discussion that the company and staff were going to get some information from her and look at some of this, but the numbers that she was laying out from her old billings and then, roughly taken off the electric part of it, sure didn't seem to match what the company was telling us. And so I don't know if anything has developed from subsequent conversations with her, or if it's possible to do some random samplings of bills from kind of the years she was mentioning. And just to clarify, what is so different about her lived experience in the same home, although with updated windows and such, or whatever all she mentioned that she had done, compared to what the company is projecting here?
Do we have her contact information?
It was taken down that night. Someone does. I don't.
We can.
Stacy could call her back, couldn't she?
Right. We frequently, when we get these type of comments all the time, and we usually mediate between the company and the individual customer.
I didn't take it down because I knew I couldn't call. Sure.
Have to at least find out the root cause of what's happening, and or if there is some sort of billing issue. So we could just follow up individually outside of the rate case to make sure that was done.
But maybe that leads to some evidence that is something that us and maybe even the company are not really understanding of how this is impacting people, and so it might have to do with the rate case too.
Good.
She seemed to feel it did. So
I guess if there's an anomaly of some sort in their billing system, or you know, because it did potentially seem like there might be, because even Dave was confused for a bit as to why it was so high. So,
and it was significant. It wasn't like we were talking about $5 or something. The numbers she was throwing out were pretty astounding.
Yeah. Yeah, we find anything out, we'll add that to a list as well.
Okay.
All right. So I'd like to explore through this rate case the potential for giving customers better price signals and opportunities to reduce their use. So whether it's time of day rates or some notification system for customers that they can, you know, reduce demand or whatever it is, there are a lot of tools available with technology now that customers should be able to, especially in a case of the, you know, something like what happened last February, have the opportunity to reduce their usage. Now, they probably heard that, you know, through the media, et cetera, in that February event, and had the opportunity that way, but they aren't as mobilized as they could be for the company's purpose with a rate structure that incentivizes them to cut. So I'd just like to explore that in this rate case.
And just so I can kind of understand conceptually, and I'll think about the specifically for the February event, of course, since all this would be going through the cost of gas rider, essentially, on a monthly basis. We'd probably, a notification probably alone would be helpful to the extent that gas prices get to a certain value, so you'd have an opportunity to reduce, rather even than a time of day use.
I'd like to look at time of day rates,
though. Time of day for gas?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't know if it's done, if it's feasible, but both, whatever. Like, let's just explore options. Think outside the box.
Got it.
Well, I can take my next one that falls right along that line, and I'm sorry, but it will take me a moment to explain. I don't know how to do it without some explanation. I feel like I have a more thorough understanding of electric than gas. I sit through SPP things, and especially renewable advocates, as we're talking about reliability issues moving forward. I often hear, well, much of this, we just need more demand response programs and such. And my understanding is, too, although maybe there is a way it can be helpful, the time of day usage, like a lot of our electric utilities use, aren't probably workable or helpful with gas, but that a lot of the demand response thing just has to do with interruptibility. And so I've gotten complaints from one of this company's commercial customers that is on an interruptible rate. And what's causing me concern here is, it's easy to keep throwing these things out about, you know, well, you know, we're going reducing our carbon footprint, and we have some of these sweet little demand response kinds of things that fixes all the problems with it, and everything is easy. And they make it sound so easy, and at first it is, until after a while it isn't anymore. And so here's what I'm hearing, and I can't attest to the reliability of this, but this is just what I'm hearing, that this customer is on interruptible rate, and during the 2021 season experienced 336 hours of outages approximately. I didn't clarify this, but I'm assuming that this happens mostly over the course of a few months. I don't know why you would really have gas outages in the summer, other than like a pipeline gets struck or something like that. I assume most of that's in a few months. And that this season, already, they're over 450. Well, if these are occurring within a few months, we're talking about being out 20% of the time already.
Is that hours? Did you see? I missed it.
Yes.
And what was the first amount? 400 and some hours?
No, 300.
Last season, it was expressed to me in days, but not like you're out for an hour on one day, and so that's a day. It was like a 24-hour period equaling one day. And however many days, I did the math on it, it came to about 336. These are approximate numbers.
336 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
For that season, and that this year they're already over 450. Okay. That seems like a lot of being out. And so what I'm wondering is, in our tariffs and in what the company offers people, are people understanding what interruptible service means when they sign up for this stuff? And especially now as their backup, which in this case is fuel oil, is expensive, and I guess in at least one case couldn't get it because the weather wasn't such that a fuel oil truck could get there. I don't know how well us or the company are making it clear to customers what they're getting with interruptible gas rates.
So you, and I guess we wouldn't be the ones making it clear to them, since they're the ones who sign up for that interruptible rate specifically. So you would like to know, I guess, how the interruptible tariff rates are applied and how they are subsequently communicated when a customer is interested in signing up for them.
Yeah, because I know people that have different demand response things with electricity, and they hardly notice that they have it, and they save some money. And so I can see the temptation, this interruptible rate, you know, yeah, so we're out for an hour once a month or something. And if the company's coming in with, you know, a 100-page contract, you know, are people just signing it, or are they really understanding what's happening? And I guess I'd like some numbers on their interruptible customers. Is this a fluke, or is this the kind of time periods during a heating season that their interruptible customers are experiencing? Because, that can't be good for our economy as a whole if our commercial people are out significant parts of the winter and sitting around and can't run their plants or whatever they all have that are operating on gas. And I was just astounded hearing these numbers of outages.
One of the places that we could make it more clear, or it could be more clear to customers, is in the tariff itself. What kind of language is in the tariff for mm-hmm. an interruptible rate? And it, you know, they could go into more detail there.
Or there could be limitations placed on how many hours can be interrupted.
Sure.
As well. have a better idea once we have all this information gathered.
Yep.
And I will say, in fairness, this is a transportation customer. And so that's a liberty. I'm not bringing this up to sit and rip on XL. I just want to understand what interruptible gas rates, how that's working out for people.
Okay. I am interested in exploring the cost of gas true up process that we have, which calls for an annual true up. Are there other ways to look at that? Like, does it have to just be annual? Could it be, what other methods could we use for predicting and then truing up the cost of gas?
Sure.
And what would be the benefits of doing it more often, I guess, for customers and for the company? And what would be the downsides?
I'm on my last of my items, and I switched the order because my last one played off of your previous one, and same thing here. So I wasn't a fan of going for the 2 years because I think it provides a big risk of starting to have these things just snowball. And to some extent, we knew at the time that this rate case was coming, but you know, it is one of the things that we've heard now. You know, people associate that cost of gas true up with a rate increase because the amount they pay every month went up. And so, you know, we're hearing it. People think, we just had a rate increase last fall and it was significant. Now you're talking about another one already. And so I think, well, you know, the 15 months, getting a few extra summer months, that kind of thing, I thought was very justifiable. I continue to think that approximately a year is the amount that we should be doing true-ups on. As consumers and as citizens, we have to take responsibility for the direction of our country and the decisions we're making and how these things are run. And I don't find it to be good rate making to push these costs off and let them start snowballing and get out into future generations. Now, I know we haven't gotten nearly that far yet, but I worry about starting. So I guess I want to say that, you know, if any of this starts evolving into a discussion of holding recovery, some of these costs off until after that true up is done, I am not a fan of pushing things off too far into the future. I think we need to set the rates at where they should properly be and deal with them.
Okay. And then I think my last one is we looked at this at Commissioner Krosh's kind of direction in their gas contracting practices, but I hope that advocacy digs more into that and perhaps explores what other states do and how, if there's better tools to incentivize the company to make the most prudent gas purchasing plans to protect the customers from the risks of the prices. So, you know, just, I think that there are some tools other states are using. I'm not saying I think we should be doing that, but it is, there is a, you know, this, we're passing along the cost of gas that the company is purchasing to the customers, and I just want to make sure that they're incentivized to get the absolute best price for that gas. So whatever we can look at to make sure that we've got the right tools in place to ensure that, whether, you know, I know there's talk about them having, other states maybe are looking at making them share in the risk of the price going up higher, et cetera. I don't know that we need to go that far, but the customers owe us really digging into this through this rate case and making sure that we have the best possible plans in place to protect from the price spikes that occurred last February.
I know we had some discussion about this with the companies already, but would you like staff, advocacy staff, specifically look into, for example, the balancing of the cost of gas storage relative? I mean, we can go through past years. I mean, staff could probably just kind of see how that, I guess that would have balanced out in previous years and how they're currently applying their gas storage policies.
That and anything else, because I know other states are looking, digging into this right now because of the cost, extreme cost of gas. So there might be other tools in the toolbox for helping protect customers from these price spikes.
Sure.
And incentivizing the companies to have the best possible gas purchasing practices in place.
I know I said my last point was my last one, but now your last one here is such a good point, and it reminds me of something that I had forgotten to write down, and you've kind of been on it. But one of the things that I found dissatisfying, I guess, in the explanation of last February event from NSP was that there's not really some more gas storage available. Well, this is a big company. Maybe you have to develop a new gas storage field. And I thought like they just kind of shrugged that off as even a possibility. And I don't know exactly what you'll look for in development of a natural gas storage field. I'm sure there are prime geological areas and others that aren't, but I never really felt like I got a good answer of why they don't develop more, because certainly MDU's impacts were minimized mm-hmm. by the amount of storage they have compared yeah. to NSP's.
Mm-hmm. Also, somebody brought this up, I can't remember where, to that point, triggered this memory. What does the potential new gas supply coming from the Bakken through that pipeline that the legislature approved, how might that affect them, if at all? Because they did talk in our discussion with them about how, you know, they didn't have great access to that lower price, the Bakken gas.
Right.
So are they looking into that, the opportunity that pipeline, which I haven't heard much about it of late, but the legislature approved the funds, and I think they're in the process of getting contracts from potential developers.
Bids.
So.
But I'm sure that'll be, in order to put in a bid, you kind of got to find a route and think about costs of acquiring easements.
Right. Well, and maybe they need to have some customers, and is XL looking at being one of the customers, maybe not owning the line, but being one of the main purchasers to make it worthwhile.
I don't know what kind of listenership we have this morning, but I never like to miss the opportunity to point out to potential developers that might be interested in that. We once cited a pipeline that was taking oil from the Bakken and crossing just south of Grand Forks, and they had found a route and had gotten, I don't know what percentage of easements, but a little research might find a possible route.
That's true.
At least that far.
That wasn't a small project citing that either.
No, but was a long ways along already.
Yeah.
It seemed like a good starting point for somebody that wanted to build a pipeline, mm-hmm. at least that far.
Okay, I don't have any more on my list.
I'm out.
Okay.
Mr. Robert Houghton?
Nothing.
Pat?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Biggest impact of the rate case is gas distribution system investment.
Pat, I don't think your mic is on.
Sorry about that. Gas distribution system investment is the biggest impact of the rate case. And there are some subcategories in that. And one of them is increasing investment because of increasing numbers of customers. And so you're looking at customer forecasts there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure the advocacy staff will look into that. NSP is implementing a integrity management program coming up here. And so, you know, we had a lot of discussion mm-hmm. with MDU about theirs. And I didn't know if you wanted to get into that with NSP, if you think advocacy should get in, look at that detail on that.
Is that listed here as a with a price tag, or how is it included in? Because it isn't called out.
No, it's included in that first one.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I think that's probably worthwhile.
Looking into the integrity.
Integrity management. It's DIMP.
DIMP.
Distribution Integrity Management.
Mm-hmm. Process plan.
What specifically, I guess just, I understand the management programs, but the, or have an idea of them, but what specifically are we looking into with it, and how it's applying as it relates to those costs? Or?
Well, it's a timing issue, mm-hmm. and it is a technology issue as well, I guess, sure. I would say, because they're deciding which they're trying to prioritize the greatest impact to public safety,
mm-hmm.
and then address it. So,
okay, now I'm tracking what you're saying.
Right, so. Gotcha. Like MDU, they said they were going to be replacing low pressure systems,
mm-hmm.
and you know, some old steel and old plastic pipe, and that's how they prioritized and determined what they were going to do first, and included costs in the rate case for that. NSP has a plan as well,
mm-hmm.
so you would want to look at the plan. And determine, you know, how they're prioritizing their replacements.
Yep.
And
what's driving their decisions.
Whether the timing is right.
Yep. It's a good one.
Yeah, because that's a really good point. Because if something's always the oldest, that doesn't mean it needs to be replaced.
And are you thinking more prospectively, or how it has been applied? We can, I guess, both. But
it's
because how it has been with costs.
The when I read about it here, it sounded prospective, but
yeah, that's what I got to that too. But they have an existing. I mean,
you guys should probably be careful to make sure you're talking into the mic so others. I'm sure
there is a normal replacement plan. I'm sure every year, but
right.
But they're just working out their integrity management plan, I believe, from what I was reading. But that would be something for staff to check into.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
One of the other things that was listed under this category was meter move-out, they call it, meter move-out plan, where they're moving inside meters out to the outside of the homes or businesses. Have they been doing that all along? I thought they had been, but... that would be something to look into, I think. Maybe not as...
You mean like, why hasn't that already happened?
Right. Or has it been happening all along?
How many are left?
And maybe, how many are left? And really,
sure.
What? How much cost and how much investment is left there?
Sure.
And then they also talked about module replacement for their gas meters. And I remember a while back we had discussions with a company, and they had their modules for automatic meter reading were freezing up. I don't know if you recall that discussion, but it was several years ago, and I thought they were replacing those modules already or had replaced them because of that problem and at least had refurbished them so that they would work. And so is the timing of this, is it the right time? One of the things they keep talking about in this, I think it's this category and other things like information technology systems, they talk about vendors are telling them that, or they're saying that vendors are saying that their systems are no longer going to be supported. And that's the case with these module replacements as well. They're saying their supplier and their contract is no longer going to be continued, no longer going to be supported. So those kinds of things, I guess, could be looked into.
Sure.
So at point is, could a decision be so bad by a company that they have to absorb the costs of it rather than their ratepayers? If you go out and, I'm not fully understanding what part, I don't recall that conversation, what's freezing up? Is it a module within a meter?
Yes, it would be the like the dial indicator, or then that dial indicator is electronic and sends a signal to the meter reader, that meter reading device.
And so if the company one time chose, I would assume when they're picking meters that they probably have multiple options from different distributors. And if you chose one because it was cheapest or because it was really hip and cool or for whatever reason and didn't take into consideration that it couldn't withstand the kinds of temperatures we have in North Dakota, is that the ratepayer's fault? At some point, does the company have to absorb some of those costs if they made a really bad decision? So maybe we need to not only ask them about how much of this is left, but why did you get meters that are freezing up?
And that issue was a while back, and so they were working with the company to resolve it. And
did
that
you hear
made
response of whether there were other alternatives that wouldn't have frozen up?
They didn't. We didn't get into that. That I recall. So the next large category is the Fargo Capacity Project. And the Fargo Capacity Project will be, I'm sure, directly assigned to North Dakota because it's all within North Dakota. So the only thing that you can look into there was the cost of that project reasonable? I know they came to us and visited with us about the project before, wanted to know whether the commission thought it was a worthwhile project, and I think it was pretty much total agreement that it was a good project.
There wasn't any formal action.
There wasn't any formal action,
it
no.
It was just off-the-hand discussion, so it really has no...
Right. But still, you have the question about whether the investment and the expense of that project was reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, as an issue in the case, right?
It could be an issue, yeah.
And is that separate from increasing customer count? Isn't the capacity project because of an increasing customer count?
It is. It was, yeah.
So it was really the same. Is the capacity project a part of the increasing customer count issue?
I mean, you could say it, yes, but there are also other customers, you know, increase other areas where customer count is increasing, and so they have other distribution costs as well.
Good.
Okay. So just to do a time check, Sherry and I have a hard stop at 1:45, so we'll have to make sure we're pushing along.
I'll try to. Under the general and intangible investment, those were the IT investments, and I was mentioned earlier about the vendors saying that they're no longer supporting.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And so it's a timing. I wonder if they want to look into that and see if what the timing on that was and perhaps the cost. Gas peaking plant refurbishing. That thing I see in that is those gas peaking plants are multi-jurisdictional, and so there's an allocation from to North Dakota concerning those plants, and there's also the question about was the investment and the cost reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of two issues there.
And I think my thoughts on the deferred maintenance might have been kind of related to both that and the capacity project. Just like it's a lot all at once. Was this, you know.
Sure.
Was there deferrals along there? What is their process for doing, making these kinds of assessments along the way? Or, you know, investments, I should say, in their plant.
Okay, the next category was administrative and general O&M expenses. And again, there's a information technology component in that category. And again, a vendor issue, I think, or a vendor question, saying that it's no longer going to be supported. The next.
That really falls into that same category. You know, we hear this a lot. Well, you got to replace something because it's no longer supported. Well, could you have bought something that would have had longer support before? You know, I'm sure sometimes not, but maybe sometimes there are. And it seems to me these companies have some responsibility to acquire things that are going to last, not just acquire things and then when they don't last, I don't want to just feel like I have no choice but to provide recovery for the replacement.
I guess there are retroactivity and prospective rate-making issues that kind of come with how we may approach that, so we can discuss that outside of this meeting to a degree.
Okay. Any more,
Pat? That comes up quite a bit, actually, by the company of vendor support. Support is going away. Property taxes seems straightforward. One of the things that I noticed on property taxes was there's an allocation change between electric and gas for the company. They're changing an allocation factor. Mm. And whenever, you know, you get into allocation factors, you want to take a look at those. It's
okay.
The allocation, I believe, is increasing expense to gas.
Okay.
Operation.
Okay.
I think that's
it for you.
That's all I have.
Good. Thank you, Pat. How about you, Jack?
Sure. There are a number of things. I'm not going to get into probably too many of them, just because I know that advocacy is going to be looking at these things. Some are really standard issues, charitable, you know, expenses, all those type of things. The long-term incentive program, course, is probably going to be a hot button issue.
Mm-hmm.
Degree. I mean, trying to get environmental as well as the time-based cost for the executive compensation. But I do think the one thing that I'll note in addition to what Pat said, most of those issues were the ones, similar ones that I had written down as well. But it goes a little broader, I guess, than just that capacity expansion, but capacity expansions in general, to the extent that that they are prudent to use and useful. I mean, that's a common rate case issue for a lot of gas distribution cases in a number of states where you'll see they'll maybe overextend, overbuild capacity for that really isn't necessary for the current need. At what point does that become used and useful? At what point in time can you actually get recovery for that? Which, hypothetically, that could be a substantial value.
Sure.
And, you know, subsequently, you can possibly get future recovery for some of those items as well. But as it currently sits, I'd like to see, or I think you guys would be interested in seeing an evaluation of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and obviously they have to, I mean, it's lumpy. It can't, just like generation, like you can't put a pipe in just for the exact number of customers you have now. If you're expecting development out in that area, that a main line has to be built to some extent for future growth, or you have to dig up the main line and make it bigger down the road. So there's a balance there, I'm assuming. So how do they determine that balance?
Well, and like I said, the other items that I kind of listed are probably either already addressed by Pat, or I know they're obvious items that staff is definitely going to hit, so yeah. I won't hit those.
I think some of the question is aid to construction costs. You know, if you're starting a new development and you got three homes out there, but you're expecting 300, does the contract, does the developer pay for some of that backbone instead of the rest of the customers?
Okay.
I guess I have two more.
We have
a couple minutes. They're changing their depreciation rates. They're actually increasing service lives, or they're extending service lives and increasing the cost of removal, the kind of like a negative salvage. And, I mean, increasing service lives reduces depreciation expense, but it isn't always the right thing to do.
Okay.
And so maybe advocacy might take a look at those new depreciation rates. And then the other thing in O&M expense and investment was that they mentioned in their rate case was mandatory relocation investments. I don't know if anybody else saw that. But perhaps, I don't know what to think about that. They are required at times when the city or the county or township or whatever, or they have projects and the company has to move their facilities. And so we end up with those costs in the right case. But is there something that could be done about timing and coordination?
Right. That's been an issue that we've talked about in a couple of these cases now. And it applies to electric, too. And I'm not comfortable that any of our utilities are coordinating as efficiently with their local public works departments as they could be to do the construction all at the same time with roads, et cetera. So just looking at that, how those two planning processes between the city, county, and the utilities work together and complement each other, I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. And to the extent that advocacy can dig into that in this case, and then we might need a separate sort of form outside of this to address it too on a broader scale. But I think we've learned several times already that there isn't much coordination that goes on. And if they have to dig it up, if the city puts a street down and they have to dig it up again a couple years later for the utility, well, that's just what has to be done. Well, I think we can potentially do a better job there.
Agreed.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's a good list of and a great discussion. Helps everyone kind of get their brain around some of the big issues. So if there's anything else, if not, good. All right. The work session is concluded. Thanks, everyone.